This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. New York Times columnist Gail Collins is with us in studio to discuss, well, the gains made by women in the last 40 years. Her book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. It's out in paperback. And she was, of course, the head of the editorial page, served as, in fact, the first woman to hold that position. She is one of my fellow Buckeyes. And in fact, well, welcome, Gail. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Delighted to have you here. I was thinking about well, the bygone era and how many young women really don't know, and I'm sure you've encountered this time and time again, what their mothers or their aunts or whatever went through. Thinking about our roots in Ohio, I remember going to college, and I'm sure you do too, when girls would start out, and they were girls at the time. They weren't women because that's what they were called.
Or co-eds.
Or co-eds. Yeah. And they were, what are you studying for your MRS degree? You remember that?
Of course, yeah.
And I mean, the whole, I was also reminded of my sister at the age of 23 being called a spinster. I mean, it's a different world.
Well, you know, one of the women I talked to for the book told me she was at Barnard during this period, and that, of course, Barnard was an all-woman school, but the seniors were given a party. And if you were engaged, you got an orchid corsage. And if you were not engaged, you got lemons. And this was Muriel Fox, who went on to be one of the founders of NOW, and was married for, I think, 50 years, but still never got over those lemons. You know, it still festered.
Well, the lemons are there in your stories.
Yeah.
I mean, you've really gotten a lot of anecdotes and a lot of personal stories here, and it's almost like an oral history, but it's also, you know, your fine journalistic skills brought to lasering beaming on what took place or didn't take place just 4 decades, 5 decades ago, and it's kind of hard, like I said, for young girls to get this into perspective.
It is, and you know, it's also difficult because frequently women my age, you know, talk to me about this, and it's like they don't understand. We had to walk 12 miles in the snow, and we weren't allowed to wear slacks, and we suffered, and they don't appreciate what we've done. We did for them, and in fact, I feel it was such a privilege to be able to be there whenever you have the chance to be fighting for something that not only do you know is right, but you know the people that you're fighting against know it's right, and you know you're going to win at the end of the whole thing. That's just such a gift. And the women in the 60s and 70s, especially in the 70s, really got to do that. And I feel very lucky. And sometimes when I talk to younger women, you know, you think, wow, that was that was kind of fun, you know?
Well, the whole second wave of feminism, which is really what we're talking about here, the women's liberation movement, everything, in many ways it came on the heels of a black liberation movement, and there were connections.
Oh, totally. The women's movement of the 60s and 70s was totally a product of the civil rights movement.
In fact, they used to say they're co-opting it with a clenched fist and all the sisterhood. And
yeah,
all
well, when they began, the very first major thing that began in the fight was a meeting that accidentally happened in Washington during a gathering of various women's groups there, in which people started talking about how they needed an NAACP for women. They needed something to take court cases and things like that. And that was the very beginning. And the very first great law that was passed prohibiting job discrimination against women was tacked onto the Civil Rights Act as a joke by opponents of the Civil Rights Act, Southern opponents of the Civil Rights Act, who were either trying to stop it or, if not that, at least make fun of it on the way through.
Well, you mentioned job discrimination, and in many respects, when you read your book, you realize how the changes that took place, and they were quantum changes, had to do with jobs. And there were many more women working during this period of Mad Men and all that than I think most people realized, as you point out.
Yeah. I mean, after the war, we have this vision that in World War II, all the women worked, and then after the war, they all went home and never came out again. But in fact, during the war, there were still many stay-at-home wives. And after the war, very quickly, you got back up to the same level of women working. They were working in different kinds of jobs, mostly sort of white and pink collar jobs, retail jobs, part-time jobs. And the reason people didn't take note of it was in part because they weren't the highest income women. They were mostly lower middle class, middle class, working class. And because the people running the media, the people doing the TV shows, the people doing the ads were all men who had stay-at-home wives. And it was considered that was the best thing you could be it was sort of a defeat if you had to send your wife out to work. It showed that you weren't really making it in the world.
You weren't really a man and a good provider. And there was also the ethos, of course, that if a woman would continue to rise up in the ranks, it meant she was taking a job away from a man.
Yeah. And also, of course, there was much of you can't manage men. Women cannot manage men. So obviously you can't be promoted past a certain level.
The anecdotes, though, are something that shines through, and all our younger women listeners, well, younger listeners in general, really ought to read these just to get a sense of what the world was like back then. I mean, women not permitted to sit in juries, advertising executive woman being kept out of a dining hall board meeting, which was all men. One of the stories that stayed in my mind, of course, is the story, and it's almost archetypical, of Lois Rabinowitz, which
yes,
you tell.
Yes, I love Lois Rabinowitz. She starts out the book. Lois Rabinowitz was a secretary in Manhattan, and on one terrible August day in the summer of 1960, she became the tabloid story of the day, which is the last thing anybody ever wants to be in New York, because she was evicted from traffic court for trying to pay a parking ticket while wearing slacks.
And the judge told her to go home and put on a skirt, basically.
Right, and she didn't have time. It was her boss's parking ticket, for heaven's sake, so she couldn't do anything else. So she called her poor husband, who ran down and paid the ticket for her.
It's also, you know, I mean, it's funny. Now you go on a plane and you see male stewardesses, Shelley Berman, you say. There should be plural flight attendants, whatever. But I remember, you know, the advertisements, Fly Me, and women being, well, measured, weighed, as you point out in your book, a woman fired simply because they discovered she was married.
Yeah, you couldn't. I mean, that was the most desirable job for a woman back then, you know. And I remember there were books, like novels, like Wendy Wins Her Wings and Silver Wings for Julie, the great drama, because that was the only job a woman could get generally that involved travel. And so it was hugely glamorous, and there were 100 or more applicants for every opening. It was really hard to get to be a stewardess. But once you got to be a stewardess, you only lasted on average about 18 months because stewardesses were not allowed to be married. And women married very early back then.
The jobs for women were pretty much nurse, teacher.
Yeah, your professional jobs were pretty much limited to nurse, teacher, librarian.
And I went back and got some statistics. Actually, I got some from your book. In 1960, you point out in your book, 6% of women were doctors, 3% were lawyers, and less than 1% were engineers. Now, in 2009, we have 47% of women doctors, 44% of the law students in 2008-2009 are women. So, as the old advertisement had it, we've come a long way, baby.
It's sort of hard to believe when you look at it all. When you think back then, you know, back in the 60s, they helpfully divided the want ads between help-wanted men and help-wanted women. And, you know, if you wanted an engineer, you knew pretty much where you were going to stick that ad. And if you wanted a receptionist, you knew where it was going to go. And people could blatantly say stuff. You know, there's a famous story Madeline Cunin told about getting out of journalism school and applying for a job. And she went to the Providence paper and they said, well, we hired a woman once as an editor, a copy editor, and she was raped in the parking lot. We'll never do it again.
That's an amazing
and then she
story.
Went to my newspaper, the New York Times, and the human resources people said, well, nothing in the newsroom, but we do have an opening for a waitress in the executive dining room if you'd like to do that.
It's just amazing. I'm sure we'll hear some stories like these from you, our listeners. In fact, let me open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us with Gail Collins. We're talking about then and now, really, the way things used to be. Also, we're reflected in the television shows, as Gail Collins makes us well aware of, in the way she traverses over popular culture at the time. Boy, I'd forgotten about Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring.
Yeah.
Until I went back and read your book. The only female puppet on Howdy Doody. Feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius. We welcome your calls. 866-733-6786. I'm sure there are many women who have stories, and I'm sure Gail would like to hear them. I would as well, but maybe some of the men out there also have some stories to tell about the way things were as opposed to the way things are, and that's pretty much the crux of a lot of what we're talking about or focusing on. You can also send an email to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. But feel free to join us now by phone. It's again, 866-733-6786, toll-free. Let's talk a little bit about TV, because the thing that, I mean, you write about My Little Margie and Armis Brooks and I Love Lucy and all those shows that those of us who are old enough remember quite well. But the thing that really knocked my socks out was, I didn't know about this. I wasn't a Trekkie or anything. The woman whose brain was transplanted to Captain. Talk about that.
I've got that episode. It's just, I watch it every once in a while. It was the first Star Trek, the original Star Trek. There was an episode in which a woman who had been a girlfriend of Captain Kirk somewhere along the line, but she had wanted to be a captain too, and you couldn't become a captain if you were a woman. So she arranged, cleverly, I thought, to have her brain secretly transplanted into Captain Kirk's. They switch brains, and they're all on the ship together. But instantly, the crew knows there's something wrong because suddenly Captain Kirk is filing his nails and having just meltdowns over the least little thing and throwing tantrums. And clearly, Mr. Spock figures this out very quickly.
And you watch this on a regular basis.
I called, actually, the Star Trek people once. I wrote a little tiny story about it, and they sighed deeply and said, well, that was the last year, and there were a lot of brain transplants going on that year.
Well, here's a segue that might surprise you, because we're talking about Star Trek, and it makes me think of Spock, a name that's often given to our president. Dr. Spock, who was really the Delphic Oracle for
baby doctor,
baby
Dr.
doctor
Spock.
And yeah. Women and men, mostly women, of course, who were raising the kids, went by him like he was scripture. And he said that for women to be competitive, well, it was disagreeable.
Yes. And he's the guy who's telling all the moms how to raise the babies. He came around later on in life during the Vietnam War, I believe. But
he was also a Buckeye. He was from Cleveland.
Was he? I didn't
yeah,
know
he was
that.
From Cleveland, Ohio.
So many Buckeyes out there. Not
yeah,
in Ohio.
And out here it's in not, California. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Transplanted. Let's go to our callers, and we're not in Ohio town here, or the state of Ohio anymore. We're in Oakland. Terry, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling to see if the author did any research on the strides of women of color. I'm a woman who's, you know, a professional woman who's worked mostly among a lot of white people, and I find my endeavors to improve my life professionally are very thwarted and difficult. Still, I mean, in general, they say that women are still making about 79 cents on the dollar for men. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, the story, you know, it's interesting. This is the second book I've done on American women's history. The first one basically went up to World War II from 1600, and then this one. And in the first one, you couldn't write about African-American women and white women in the same chapters even, because their lives were so completely and totally different. And it's really, as this story goes on, it kind of begins in the same place where African-American women and white women are living lives that are very separate. And when the civil rights movement came, a lot of white women joined the civil rights movement and then wanted to move on to what became the women's liberation movement. For black women, it was a complicated period. There was the question of where their allegiances first were, and mainly most black women felt their allegiance was first for racial justice.
Or to their men, as some of them said.
Some said
then,
that, yeah. But interestingly, within the civil rights movement, you know, although the black women within the civil rights movement suffered a lot from sexual segregation and discrimination. You know, Rosa Parks had to walk with the wives during the march on Washington, and there were no women who spoke at the Great March on Washington when Martin Luther King made his great I Have a Dream speech. And black women were very conscious of all that, it was a tangled period, I think, for a lot of black women. And we've kind of moved on, I think, past that. It's perfectly easy, I find, at least for most black women, to feel confident about striving for justice, both for race and gender, without feeling that there's a fight or a conflict going on. And to be absolutely honest, the women's liberation movement early on, a lot of the women who were leading it in the Betty Friedan era were mainly thinking about middle-class white women. I mean, they were not certainly racist. They were concerned about black women. But it was a movement whose concerns were really about suburban white women who were dissatisfied even though they had college degrees.
I remember Ms. and under Gloria Steinem really tried to dispel some of that. They were putting
Gloria
black women
Steinem
out in front.
Gloria Steinem was such a heroine on that. To this very day, you know, she's just always, always conscious of making sure that there's a consideration of race and ethnicity in everything that she does. She was not absolutely normal for that period, though.
Another Ohio.
Ohio
women.
Too
chauvinistic,
you know,
here about Ohio.
This is a total brag, and you're going to just be overwhelmed with jealousy. But I was inducted into the Ohio Women's Hall of Fame a while ago, and I got there, and there's like practically a statue to Gloria Steinem. It is so cool. It's just very, very neat.
Well, I'm envious. Is there an Ohio Men's Hall of Fame?
I don't think there is.
I'm in the Cleveland Heights High School Hall of Fame.
Well, that's good. That's really good.
Talking to Gail Collins. again, the book is When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. It's out in paperback. And the thing that's documented in this book is also, again, young women probably just can't realize you couldn't get property deed unless you had the signature of your husband. Your husband could be in a mental institution. You could be divorced. You could be the main earner. It didn't matter. You needed your husband's signature.
There are many famous stories like that that came up, of course, later because it was considered very normal back at that time. In fact, you know, I've got my first credit card that I ever got in my life, which was when I was first married back in the, the early 70s. And it's for Mrs. Daniel Collins, you know, and I've just it's still there.
So is that name Collins.
Actually, when we got married, the postman told us that he was not going to deliver mail unless we had the same name.
Well, you'd be living in sin, maybe. Huh? Let me go to more callers. And Elizabeth is our next caller. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Well, I'm living in Menlo Park now, but originally I was from Washington, D.C., and I went to a private school there, which told us we could do anything we girls wanted to do. But there was a caveat in that. Really, we were supposed to do it as wives of famous and rich people. Anyway, I believed it. I went to UCLA trying to get a degree in zoology, and that wasn't easy because, as a woman, I was made fun of by the department and suffered the usual problems of a woman in a man's field.
Forgive me, Elizabeth. We're talking about the 50s here?
We're talking about the 50s.
Yeah, okay.
So I know this started in the 60s, but I just wanted to tell this story that my children grew up with this story so that they would do better. Anyway, as a senior, I took a graduate course, did very well, wrote a paper that my professor was thrilled with, and he asked me to come back as his graduate student in the fall. And this was really thrilling because you know, you absolutely had to have a well-known professor to sponsor you. So I came back in the fall to register as a graduate student, and he told me to my face that he could not take me as a graduate student, and he wouldn't sign my papers. And so I didn't know what to do, but you can continue, or I could at the time, without a sponsor for at least 6 months, so I did. And then a male graduate student in the department told me the reason. He said, of course, you realize why he couldn't take you. And I said, no, I have no idea. He said, because his wife told him she would divorce him if he took a woman graduate student.
Whew.
Zoology. However, I did marry a zoologist and sort of kept in touch, but that was as close as I could ever get.
Well, that's
quite thank you
story.
For that story.
Yeah. Thank you indeed, Elizabeth. And Karen is our next caller. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I wanted to share a story about my cousin, who in 1969 was hired by AT&T. But before she could get the job, she had to take a pregnancy test, which boggles my mind to think that a woman would have to take a pregnancy test.
It wasn't uncommon, Gail, was it?
No. No, in fact, and also if you wanted to, say, take out a mortgage with your husband, they wouldn't count your income toward the mortgage unless you could prove that you had been sterilized, because the presumption was that you would have a baby right away.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that she was pregnant, but they used the old rabbit test. So I guess that wasn't accurate until about 3 months or so.
The rabbit continued onward, isn't it?
And so she revealed, I guess, probably when she was about 6 months pregnant, that she was pregnant, and they let her keep the job. And she was unmarried, which I'm sure was quite scandalous at the time. But it was just interesting how things worked out. But when she shared that story about the pregnancy test, I couldn't believe it.
Well, believe it. And thank you for the call.
Thank you.
There's some emails I want to read. Katrina writes, my godmother is forever telling me how her generation changed everything. I agree, but it seems women are divided into two roles, modern working women and homemakers, mothers. If anything's clear, it's that we can't have it all. What are we to do? I want to work and build something for myself, but I also want a family. It's almost too much to fight against male-dominated culture and my biological clock.
If you, you know, I often younger women ask me, you know, how can I really have a spectacular career that I can devote myself to, and also I want to have a family. How do I do it? And I'm given the society we live in, the answer is you've got to have a partner who is really, really willing to take up half the load. It's the guys out there's lives have changed as much as the women's have in many ways, and you know, you see so many. I was at a meeting at a college that was it's a public college where most of the students are the first one in their and their family to ever go to college, you know, sort of very working class backgrounds. And there were men and women in the group, young students, and I asked the guys, how many of you, when you're looking toward a serious relationship with a woman, somebody you might want to marry, how many of you consider whether or not she's going to be a good earner? And they all raised their hands, and that so knocked me out. It's so necessary now for both members of a couple to work in order to maintain a middle-class lifestyle. And, you know, I know so many men now who have moved for their wives' jobs, or I have a story I love telling about a guy I worked with whose wife also worked at the Times, and they had young children, and she was sent off to Kosovo to cover the war. He came in one day looking dead, and I said, what is wrong with you? And he said, my wife's in Albania, and the hamster's missing. And I thought, that's the saga of men in our country. So you got to find a really good partner, a really good husband or partner.
Lori writes, I had a friend who was desperate to become an American Airlines stewardess back in 1984. American Airlines was still insistent that stewardesses could not be married and had to meet certain physical standards of weight and appearances. She caught shingles, and it manifested on her neck and cheek. She had to provide a doctor's note to AA certifying that the scars would disappear, and this is only 26 years ago. And another listener writes, even though we are finding it funny and looking at our own history of how women were treated, it should give us some pause on the pace we are expecting other societies like those in Afghanistan and the Middle East to swiftly catch up with our cultural norms. Maybe we shouldn't just be justifying wars on the basis of how women are being treated. Would we have accepted a foreign power to free women here?
We probably wouldn't have. But, you know, I am totally in the camp of my colleague Nick Kristof, who's written a great book about the subject of women in the Middle East and underdeveloped countries called Half the Sky.
Yeah, which we talked about here on Forum with him.
It's a spectacular book. And his strong feeling, and I totally believe it, is that however we get there, you're never going to get to a peaceful resolution of the Middle East until women in those countries have equal rights.
We bring in more of our callers, and Rick, you're next. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell a story. I started law school at the University of Minnesota in 1966, and out of a class of 250, there were three women. And many of my classmates were so enraged that any woman would have the nerve to take a man's place in the class, and they gave these women so much grief that two of them quit within the first 2 months of our first year in law school. The one who remained was my moot court partner our last year in law school. We had a great time. She was an absolutely wonderful student. The other story, which is more to the point of which I'm not hearing, a woman that I knew very, very well and loved in the early 1980s became a medical assistant in a hospital back in the Midwest when she was 18 in the late 1960s. And after working there for about a month, the doctor told her that she had a choice of taking her clothes off or he was going to blackball her and she would never work in medical industry again. She kept the job, did what she had to do, and was, I think, starred for it for life.
Yeah.
And the man just felt he had the power to do that.
Well,
thank you. That's a very good point. You're absolutely
right.
That
kind of sexual harassment was much more common than most people realize.
Oh, totally. And it went way back. You know, if you look at the very earliest ads for secretaries or receptionists back in the early 1900s, they almost frequently say attractive blonde or pleasingly plump person. I mean, it's clearly they're planning to do more with this young woman than have her type stuff. And it was so normal that many young women didn't even think it was it. You know,
and the laws weren't there. I mean, in terms of
the idea that your boss would pat you on the behind or make suggestive comments to you or stuff like that. And your caller is right. Women for whom that became a huge power thing, people just basically telling them you have to submit or you're doomed. It scarred them for life.
Let me bring another caller in. Ellen, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I am part of that younger generation, and my mother-in-law told me a story that just blew my mind, because she's a young woman from my perspective. She's in her late 50s, and even so, her and her now-was husband were living together, and they couldn't live in the state of Connecticut. And when he was going for the bar in New York, instead of being asked the scary "did you smoke pot" question, it was all about her and his living in sin. And this isn't something that's past history. This is just our previous generation. It's just amazing.
Yeah, in 1968, there was a story in the New York Times, one of our trend stories, announcing with breathless wonder that college students, male and female, were living in the same apartments when they weren't married. And there were interviews with three or four couples, and they were all using pseudonyms because this was considered so incredibly shocking that nobody would ever want to go on the record.
All right. I'm going on the record again about Ohio for the last time because, I was educated there. And in the 60s, and I tell my students this, and they find absolutely beyond belief, you couldn't have a woman in your room if you lived in a dormitory or any kind of housing. If maybe Christmas time, you'd leave the door open and all 4 feet had to be on the floor. But there was what they called student-approved housing and unapproved housing. And the approved housing, in order to live in approved housing, had to have a married couple there. The married couple could be younger than you.
Right.
But if they were a married couple, the imprimatur went on it as approved
housing. They're serious people, yeah.
It was crazy. And I mean, it was the first thing that got me to be a protester.
And that, again, the amazing thing about all this stuff is how fast it changed. And somebody, I think it was Nora Ephron, told me that, she went to a college that everybody, you could have boys up one day a year, 3 feet on the floor at all times, and the door must be open and all that stuff. And that was there when she went there. And 5 years later, she went back, and there were co-ed dorms, and the guys were running around naked in the halls from the shower. So it just changed so fast. It was hard
to believe. And it keeps changing, doesn't it? On that note, Gail Collins, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Gail Collins' book, Everything Changed, is out in paperback now, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our interns, Elena Kadvani, Aiden Stone, Suki Lewis, engineers, Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.